The Eagle's Shadow by James Branch Cabell.
25. For at the height of this particularly mischancy posture of affairs, the meddlesome fates had elected to dispatch Cockeye Flinks to serve as our deus ex machina. And just as in the comedy the police turn up in the nick of time to fetch Tartuffe to prison, or in the tragedy Friar John manages to be detained on his journey to Mantua and thus bring about that lamentable business in the Tomb of the Capulets, so Mr. Flinks now happens inopportunely to arrive upon our lesser stage. Faithfully to narrate how Cockeye Flinks chanced to be at Selwood were a task of magnitude. That gentleman traveled very quietly, and for the most part, he journeyed incognito under a variety of aliases, suggested partly by a fertile imagination, and in part by prudential motives. For his notions of proprietary rights were deplorably vague, and his acquaintance with the police, in consequence, extensive. And finally, that he was now at Selwood was not in the least his fault, but all the doing of an N and O brakesman, who had an uncultured argument reinforced by a coupling pin, persuaded Mr. Flinks to disembark from the northern freight on the night previous. Mr. Flinks, then, sat leaning against a tree in the gardens of Selwood, some 30 feet from the wall that stands between Selwood and Gridlington, and nursed his pride and foot, both injured in that high debate of last evening, and with a jackknife rounded off the top of a substantial staff designed to alleviate his present lameness. Meanwhile, he tempered his solitude with music, whistling melodiously the air of a song that pertained to the sacredness of home and of a white-haired mother. Subsequently to Cockeye Flinks, as the playbill has it, enter a vision in violet ruffles. Wide-eyed she came upon him in her misery, steadily trudging toward an unknown goal. I think he startled her a bit. Indeed, it must be admitted that Mr. Flinks, while a man of undoubted talent in his particular line of business, was, like many of your great geniuses, in outward aspect unprepossessing and misleading. For whereas he looked like a very shiftless and very dirty tramp, he was, as a matter of fact, as vile a rascal as ever pawned a swinish soul for whiskey. "What are you doing here?" said Margaret sharply. "Don't you know this is private property?" To his feet rose Cockeye Flinks. "Lady," said he with humbleness, "you wouldn't be hard on a poor working man, would you? It ain't my fault I'm here, lady. At least it ain't rightly my fault. I just climbed over the wall to rest a minute. Just a minute, lady, in the shade of these beautiful trees. I ain't a-hurtin' nobody by that, lady, I hope."
"Well, you had no business to do it," Miss Hugonin pointed out, "and you can just climb right back." Then she regarded him more intently, and her face softened somewhat. "What's the matter with your foot?" she demanded.
"Brakesman," said Mr. Flinks briefly, "threw me off a train. He struck me cruel hard, he did. And me, a poor workingman trying to make my way to New York, lady, where my poor old mother's dying, lady, and me out of a job. Ah, it's a hard, hard world, lady. And me, her only son, and he struck me cruel, cruel hard, he did, but I forgive him for it, lady. Ah, lady, you're so beautiful, I know you've got a kind, good heart, lady. Can't you do something for a poor workingman, lady, with a poor dying mother and a poor sick wife?" Mr. Flinks added as a dolorous afterthought, and drew nearer to her and held out one hand appealingly. Petheridge Jukesbury had at diverse times pointed out to her the evils of promiscuous charity, and these dicta Margaret parroted glibly enough to do her justice, so long as there was no immediate question of dispensing alms. But for all that, the next whining beggar would move her tender heart, his glib inventions playing upon it like a fiddle, and she would give as recklessly as though there were no such things in the whole wide world as soup kitchens and organized charities and common sense. "Because, you know," she would afterward salve her conscience, "I couldn't be sure he didn't need it, whereas I was quite sure I didn't." Now she wavered for a moment. "You didn't say you had a wife before," she suggested. "An invalid," sighed Mr. Flinks. "A helpless invalid, lady. And 6 small children probably crying for bread at this very moment. Ah, lady, think what my feelings must be to hear 'em cry in vain. Think what I must suffer to know that I summoned them cherubs out of heaven into this here hard, hard world, lady, and now can't do by 'em properly."
And Cockeye Flinks brushed away a tear, which I, for one, am inclined to regard as a particularly ambitious flight of his imagination. Promptly, Margaret opened the bag at her waist and took out her purse. "Don't,"
she pleaded. Please don't. I'm upset already. Take this and please, oh please don't spend it in getting drunk or gambling or anything horrid, Miss Hugonin implored him. You all do, and it's so selfish of you, and so discouraging. Mr. Flinks eyed the purse hungrily. Such a fat purse, thought Cockeye Flinks. And there ain't nobody within a mile of here, neither. You are not to imagine that Mr. Flinks was totally abandoned. His vices were parochial, restrained for the most part by a lively apprehension of the law. But now the spell of the eagle was strong upon him. Lady, said Mr. Flinks, twisting in his grimy hand the bill she had given him. And there, too, the eagle flaunted in his vigor and heartened him. Lady, that ain't much for you to give. Can't you do a little better than that by a poor workingman, lady? A very unpleasant-looking person, Mr. Cockeye Flinks. Oh, a peculiarly unpleasant-looking person. To be a model son and a loving husband and a tender father. Margaret was filled with a vague alarm. But she was brave, was Margaret. No, said she, very decidedly. I shan't give you another cent. So you climb right over that wall and go straight back where you belong. The methods of Mr. Flinks, I regret to say, were somewhat more crude than those of Madame Haggage and Saumarez and Messieurs Canaston and Jukesbury. Cheese it, said Mr. Flinks, and flung away his staff and drew very near to her. Give me that money, do you hear? Don't you dare touch me, she panted. Ah, don't you dare. Ah, hell, said Mr. Flinks disgustedly, and his dirty hands were upon her, and his foul breath reeked in her face. In her hour of need, Margaret's heart spoke. Billy, she wailed. Oh, Billy, Billy! He came to her, just as he would have scaled heaven to come to her, just as he would have come to her in the nethermost pit of hell if she had called. Ah, yes, Billy Woods came to her now in her peril, and I don't think that Mr. Flinks particularly relished the look upon Billy's face as he ran through the gardens, for Billy was furiously moved. Cockeye Flinks glanced back at the wall behind him. 10 feet high, and the fellow ain't far off. Cockeye Flinks caught up his staff, and as Billy closed upon him, struck him full on the head. Again and again he struck him. It was a sickening business. Billy had stopped short. For an instant he stood swaying on his feet, a puzzled face showing under the trickling blood. Then he flung out his hands a little, and they flapped loosely at the wrists, like wet clothes hung in the wind to dry, and Billy seemed to crumple up suddenly and slid down upon the grass in an untidy heap. Ah, said Mr. Flinks. He drew back and stared stupidly at that sprawling flesh, which just now had been a man, and was seized with uncontrollable shuddering. Ah, said Mr. Flinks very quietly, and Margaret went mad. The earth and the sky dissolved in many floating specks, and then went red. Red like that heap yonder. The veneer of civilization peeled, fell from her like snow from a shaken garment. The primal beast woke and flicked aside the century's work. She was the cave woman who had seen the death of her mate, the brute who had been robbed of her mate. Damn you! Damn you! She screamed, her voice high, flat, quite unhuman. Ah, God in heaven, damn you! With inarticulate, bestial cries, she fell upon the man who had killed Billy, and her violet fripperies fluttered. Her impotent little hands beat at him, tore at him. She was fearless, shameless, insane. She only knew that Billy was dead. With an oath, the man flung her from him and turned on his heel. She fell to coaxing the heap in the grass to tell her that he forgave her, to open his eyes, to stop bloodying her dress, to come to luncheon. A fly settled on Billy's face and came in his zigzag course to the red stream trickling from his nostrils and stopped short. She brushed the carrion thing away, but it crawled back drunkenly. She touched it with her finger and the fly would not move. On a sudden, every nerve in her body began to shake and jerk like a flag snapping in the wind.